Turn to Proverbs 9 and verse 14. We're getting close to the end of Proverbs 9, and I'm getting excited as I'm working ahead. I've got into chapter 10 already, and it's nice to actually get into the Proverbs after over 3 years, because the Proverbs begin in chapter 10. And so, anyway, but we still have a little bit of time here in Proverbs 9. Verse 14 says, "For she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the highest places of the city." Now the "she" there is the foolish woman. In verse 13, a foolish woman is clamorous. She is simple and knoweth nothing, for she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the highest places of the city. So as we've talked about already, the foolish woman represents Satan and his church. And we see here that Satan has a house. It says she sitteth at the door of her house. He's got a house, and wisdom has a house. Wisdom represents Jesus Christ and his church. And we see that in Proverbs 9 and verse 1. Wisdom hath builded her house. She hath hewn out her seven pillars. So wisdom's got a house, and the foolish woman has a house. And these are both representative of churches, God's church, Satan's church. Let me just show you that Jesus' church is called the house, or a house. It's called the house of God. And I'll show you that Satan's religion is called a house too, which is interesting. Now, if you turn to Matthew 16 and verse 18, familiar words to us all. Jesus said, "And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Now, if you compare that with some other verses, we're going to see that Jesus' church is his house. Ephesians 2:19 through 22. Here it's called a habitation. It's called a household, and it's called a habitation, which is another word that means a house. I'll define that here in a minute. Ephesians 2:19 through 22. "Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners." He's talking to the Gentiles, who used to be excluded from the commonwealth of Israel. They had no part in God's religion because they weren't Israelites. They were strangers and foreigners, but now no more. "Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God." That's a house. "And are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth unto an holy temple in the Lord." And the temple in the Old Testament was called the Lord's house. It was called a house as well. Houses are built upon a foundation with stones. This is what this is talking about, only this is speaking of a spiritual house, spiritual stones, spiritual foundation. "In whom ye also are builded together for an habitation," which is a house, "of God through the Spirit." Now I'll give you a verse that just says it, that the church is the house of God, in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15. 1 Timothy 3, verse 15. Now you probably knew that God's church is called a house, but you might not have known that Satan's church is called a house, and I'm going to show you that, so that might be some new information here in a minute. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15, it says, "But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." So that verse right there defines for us that the church of the living God is the house of God. It's God's habitation. It's where he dwells. He dwelt in the tabernacle under Moses. He dwelt in the temple under Solomon and forward. And then on the day of Pentecost, the Spirit filled the church, and God dwells in the church, in the house of God, the spiritual building. Let me give you a couple more. In Hebrews 3 and verse 6. Hebrews 3 and verse 6. It says, "But Christ is a son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end." So he says, we are the house. This is why he said we're builded together in habitation of God through the Spirit, and we're lively stones, and we'll get to that verse here next. But this house is comprised of us. We are it. When the Excelsior Springs Church assembles together, we are the stones. We are the building. spiritual building. And here there's a, but it's contingent upon something. We are whose house we are if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end. What happens if you don't hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing and the hope firm unto the end? You're not the house of God anymore.
You're going to be not in it.
Right, you're going to be excluded. Mm-hmm. The house of the church is going to fall apart if the whole church does that, and you're not the house of God anymore. Mm-hmm. You might be a child of God, but you're a child of God that doesn't have any assurance of that, and you're certainly not part of his house where God dwells anymore. That's why we want to be very careful, to be very jealous of this house and to guard it and to not let ourselves fall away from it. I'll give you one more verse. 1 Peter 2 and verse 5. Ye also as lively stones, living stones, in other words, are built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. You have to have the eyes of faith to see this. That's why people will come in and they'll visit our church and all they see is a group of people meeting in a rented room, or a free room in our case, which is pretty nice. But that's all they see. They see a Bible study group, maybe. I mean, they don't see anything more than just some people that get together and have a meeting. But the eyes of faith see that this is indeed the very house of God. These are spiritual stones built upon the foundation of Jesus Christ, the chief cornerstone, and the apostles, which are the foundational stones. People that can see it. But people that don't have the eyes to see it don't. To them, it's just another group of people, and a group of people with some strange beliefs and some restrictive ideas about things, about certain holidays we should or shouldn't celebrate and stuff like that. And they're like, yeah, I'd rather go to a real church down the road. You know, they actually have a building, you know, because real churches have buildings. You know, fake churches don't have buildings, and in people's minds, of course. All right, so God's house is God's church is a house, and Satan's church is also a house. Satan's church is represented by a whorish woman or a foolish woman. Proverbs 9 is that foolish woman, and we see that this foolish woman is a whorish woman that Satan's church is in Revelation 17, verses 1 through 6. Revelation 17, 1 through 6. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. The waters are nations and people and multitudes and tongues there in verse 15. So this is a spiritual whore that sits on many places of the globe. It's spread across nations and tongues, and it's pretty much all over the world. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So the kings of the earth are in bed with this religious whore. The Catholic Church, of course, historically has been in bed with governments, and there was many times where popes ordained kings or kings ordained popes, and they have been very interconnected. King Henry VIII couldn't get himself a divorce, so he broke off from the Catholic Church and became his own pope. He wanted to do that. So there was, you know, the pope had a lot of power over the state, and the state had a lot of influence in the Catholic Church as well. Verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw the woman, this is that whore on many waters, I saw the woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Now this beast is this series of world empires. It's a seven-headed beast, and up until this point, there were six heads had already come, and he talks about that later in the chapter. There was one to come and another one after that, which would be the eighth. But this is the world system, the world, these series of world empires, and the woman, this religion, sits on top of the beast. She rides on the beast. She is an integral part of that religion. And that's how, historically, these empires maintained their power, was through religion, because they could threaten people with, that the emperor would have the power of life and death, spiritual life and death, and the emperor could damn you. And the Egyptians believed that, or the Pharaoh, the other empires, the Roman Empire was the same thing. That's the emperor of the Roman Empire was called the Pontifex Maximus, which is then what the Pope became called after that. So anyway, she's always been, you know, she's been part and parcel of that system riding on its back. And so she's full of names of blasphemy, Mary, you know, Mother of God, Holy Father, you know, names like that, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, and having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. You ever been to a Catholic cathedral or a Catholic church building, and you see all the gold and all the jewels and all the paintings and the, you know, all these statues and things like that? She's arrayed very beautifully. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the Mother of Harlots and Abominations of the Earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. He marveled at this woman. He didn't admire her like we think about it today, where he was positively impressed by her. But he looked at her and thought, wow, this is a frightening monstrosity. And that's the Catholic Church for you. Drunk with the blood of the saints. The Catholic Church has murdered tens of millions of Christians over the years, in the Inquisition and the Crusades. So this is the woman. This is that foolish / whorish woman that represents Satan's religion. And his church is also a house. It's a habitation. Revelation 18 continues to talk about this mystery Babylon the Great. And in verse 2, it says, and he cried, Revelation 18, 2, and he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and it has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. So she is become the habitation of devils. And I would say she always was. She, you know, was certainly full of satanic doctrine, the doctrines of devils, the Bible calls it. Habitation is the action of dwelling in or inhabiting as a place of residence, occupancy by inhabitants. It's a place of abode or residence, either the region or country inhabited, or now more usually a house, cave, or other particular dwelling place of man or animal. So habitation is a dwelling place, it's a house. So Mystery Babylon here is a house of devils. God's church, on the other hand, is a house, it's his habitation, through the Spirit. So God dwells in his church, the devil and the other devils dwell in his church, in his house. Look at Psalm 26 and verse 8. I'll show you that God dwells in his church. See, Satan always has to imitate the Most High. God's got a church, Satan has to have one. God's church is his house where he dwells. Well, Satan's church is his house where he dwells. God's got ministers in his church, Satan's got ministers in his church. They're transformed into ministers of righteousness, it says there in 2 Corinthians. So the devil's always trying to as closely mimic God to trick men into coming over to his side as he can. That's why he calls his churches churches. That's why he calls his Bibles Bibles. That's why he calls his Jesus Jesus. Right. It wouldn't work if he called them other things. Everybody'd recognize, oh, that's not the real thing. But if it's got the same name, most people don't look any deeper than that. Psalm 26 and verse 8. It says, Lord, I have loved the habitation of thy house and the place where thine honor dwelleth. See, there you have habitation and house kind of defining each other. And it's the place where God dwells. And then Ephesians 2:22 we already looked at, which says that the house is a habitation of God through the Spirit. Now, this is interesting. Satan's various places of false religion are also called houses. See, Satan has, God only has one church, one real church, right? Many local churches, but he only has one institution that is his church. He had the Jerusalem church, and then every other church was went out from that, and they're of the same type and kind of that church, right? But Satan, he's got all kinds of different houses, all kinds of different churches. His religions are diverse and sundry, because, you know, it's easy to get the most people in that way. You have, you know, it's like the Burger King church, you know, have it your way, right? So if you don't like this one, oh, I got another one for you, right? So let me just show you some of his houses. 1 Samuel 5 and verse 2. 1 Samuel 5 and verse 2. I actually got that line from my brother. He told me about the Burger King churches. Have it your way. And yeah, I think he's right, yeah. 1 Samuel 5 and verse 2. It says, when the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. There's Dagon was the Philistine god, and he had a house. It was the house of Dagon. How about 1 Samuel 31, 9 through 10? 1 Samuel 31, 9 through 10. This is after Saul had died, and they'd hung him up on the wall, decapitated him. Well, I'll tell you about it right here. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth. And they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan, Ashtaroth, which is another name for the female fertility goddess, otherwise known as Ishtar or Ishtra or Easter. That's where Easter comes from. So they had a sunrise service there, put Saul's armor in the house of Easter. And then it says there the house of their idols. So you have all these different houses, like I said. How about 1 Kings 16 and verse 32? 1 Kings 16, 32. It says, and he reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. Baal was the counterpart of Ashtaroth, or Ishtar, or Istra. Baal was the sun god, and Ashtaroth was Venus, and the female god, and they get together on Easter and make some babies, and that's what everybody's celebrating whenever they celebrate Easter, whether they realize it or not. How about 2 Kings 5 and verse 18? I told some guys that when I was on active duty when I was deployed, and it was Easter time, and they said something about celebrating Easter, I forget. And I said, well, if you really want to celebrate Easter properly, you should go have an orgy. And, you know, just to provoke them to thought anyway. And then they were curious about that anyway. I got to explain it, but. Although to tell those reprobates that, they'd have probably done it, so that probably wasn't a good idea. But.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. 2 Kings 5 and verse 18. It says, in this the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master, this is just the background here, this is Naaman the Syrian. This is after he was cleansed, and he now has been converted. But he's going back to Syria, and he serves this master, and this master is an idolater, and this master was apparently very old, and he had to go in there and help him into this temple, or this worship house here, the house of Rimmon, as we'll read. And so anyway, this is what he's asking about here. And verse 18, in this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaneth on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing. And he said unto him, go in peace. So he departed from him a little way. So here's another house of Rimmon. Now, somebody might take this passage, and this would be very erroneous, and say, see, when you get converted, you can still go and worship in your former religion. You can go to church with your parents and worship. I mean, if they're members of the Church of Satan or they're Catholics or whatever, you can go in there and worship right along with them. I mean, kneel with them, bow with them, just go right through the motions, walk right up to the front and take the bread and the wine in the Catholic Church, because I mean, he told Naaman to go ahead. But look at what he says there. He goes in with his master, and he leaneth on my hand, which tells me the guy's probably really old and he needs help, and he's bowing down, probably getting down on his knees like they do in the Catholic Church, and he needs help to get down. He needs help to get back up. Naaman's going to help him down. He's going to help him back up. Naaman's not worshiping Rimmon in this house. Naaman is helping his master to go do his idolatry. So there'd be a difference. This would be kind of like accompanying an aged parent to a Catholic Mass. If your parent was totally convinced in their conscience that this is the thing that they should do, they should go to a Catholic Mass, and you walked in there with them and helped them and helped them kneel down and helped them get back up. I don't really recommend that, but this would be what this would be akin to. And you would not be worshiping a Catholic God by doing that. Right? You might be, you could say you were enabling your parents, but you could say Naaman was enabling his master as well, and the prophet was okay with that. So anyway, that's what's going on there, in case you wondered. But that's kind of getting afield. All I really wanted there was the house of Rimmon. And then 2 Kings 19:37. This will be the last one. 2 Kings 19 and verse 37. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his son, smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia. And Esar-Haddon, his son, reigned in his stead. This was Sennacherib. We were over this not that long ago with Hezekiah. You'll remember that Sennacherib was boasting how he was going to destroy Jerusalem, and the Lord destroyed 185,000 of his soldiers in one night. And after that, he decided it was probably a good idea to go back to Syria. And he went back to the house of his god there, Nisroch, and he got himself killed. Hezekiah went to the house of God and got himself some 15 more years. Sennacherib went to the house of his god and got himself dead. Now, satanic religions call their churches, satanic religions are called churches to deceive the simple. I actually have a biblical example of this, believe it or not, in Acts 19 and verse 37. Acts 19 and verse 37. So we were just over this the other day too, for another reason. When Paul went to Ephesus and he got Demetrius all upset because he was afraid he was going to lose his business making these shrines for Diana, the god of the Ephesians, and he creates this uproar. And so this guy here, the town clerk, is trying to calm down the people. And he says in verse 36, seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, because everybody knows that Diana fell down from Jupiter. I mean, you know, this is unassailable. This is just, you know, self-evident, clearly. I mean, there's just no argument here, obviously. Seeing that these things cannot be spoken against, ye ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly, for ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches nor yet blasphemers of your goddess. Robbers of churches. He's not talking about Thessalonica and Galatia and Cappadocia and Bithynia, right? These other, you know, churches in the New Testament, Antioch and Jerusalem. He's talking about the houses of these idols, right? Because a church is a congregation, right? Well, there are congregations of all kinds of false religions. Congregations are where people congregate, where they assemble together. So that's what a church is by definition. So when he says they're not robbers of churches, these guys, yeah, they may be telling people Diana's no god, and maybe that's gonna, you know, that's gonna create some problems for your business, Demetrius, but they're not going in and robbing your church buildings, right? They're not robbing your people. They're not actually physically aggressing against you. So leave them alone, is what he's saying. But the interesting thing is he calls these idol temples churches. So everything that's called a church is not necessarily the church of Jesus Christ. It's not the church of God. Now, it's interesting. Like I said, Satan has a broad array of religions. He also has a synagogue where people who claim to be Jews worship. Revelation 2 and verse 9. He's got churches, he's got synagogues, he's got temples, he's got it all. Whatever you like, he can offer it to you. Revelation 2 and verse 9. I know thy works. Jesus is speaking to the church in Smyrna here. He says, I know thy works in tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. You know, there were people in Jesus' day that were calling themselves Jews that weren't. They thought they were Jews. They claimed to be the seed of Abraham, but they weren't the children of Abraham. They weren't the children of promise. They were, Jesus said, ye are of your father the devil. They were going to a synagogue, Satan's synagogue. God had departed that whole system at that point. God's done with it. By the time the book of Revelation is written, those are synagogues of Satan. They're not God's synagogues anymore. Those are unbelieving, Christ-rejecting Jews that are going to those synagogues, and they are of the synagogue of Satan. Look at Revelation 3 and verse 9. It says the same thing again. To the church in Philadelphia, behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews, and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. You see, those people claim to be Jews, like I said, but weren't. I'll just give you a verse or two that'll just back that up in Romans chapter 2, verse 28. Now look at what it says here. They say they are Jews, but are not, right? Look at what Paul says. He is not a Jew, which is one outwardly. He's one outwardly. He's been born into a Jewish family. He's been circumcised. He goes to the synagogue, right? Paul says he's not a Jew, which is one outwardly. Neither is that circumcision, which is outward in the flesh. That's not real, true circumcision. But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, a Jew on the inside. He's got a changed heart. And circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit and not of the letter, whose praise is not of men but of God. That's a true Jew. That's one of God's true chosen people. You and I. You know what tribe we're of? Tribe of Judah. We're in Christ, and he's the tribe of Judah. So if anybody ever asks you that, because that can be one they trip you up with, you say, well, we're Jews. We're true Jews. Oh, yeah, well, what tribe are you? Judah. And the funny thing is, the guy that would say that to you, especially if he was a Jew, he'd say, what tribe are you? You could turn it around and say, what tribe did your Caucasian ancestors come from, you know, up there in Khazaria? I'm just as much a biological Jew as you probably are, more than likely. I'm Caucasian just like you are, buddy. Anyway. Because that's where about upwards of 90% of the so-called Jews today come from, the Khazars. They were Turkish mongrels, basically. Mongols, not mongrels. Mongols, but anyway. Up there in the Caucasus Mountains, that's why they're people up there are called Caucasians. That's why I say the Jews today, supposedly, are Caucasians, just like us. They're Eastern Europeans, most of them. But anyway. I have other verses, but I should probably get on with this. In Philippians, Philippians 3 and verse 3 is another one, which talks about who the true Jews are. But anyway. So Satan has lots of counterfeit religions, lots of counterfeit churches out there. Now, getting back to this foolish woman. So the foolish woman is said to sit. She sits on a seat at her house. Now it said, Proverbs 9 and verse 4, for she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city. So I think it's interesting. The foolish woman sits at the door of her house to call men into it, while wisdom stands in the top of high places to call unto men to repent. Look at the difference here. In Proverbs 8, 1 through 3, doth not wisdom cry and understanding put forth her voice? She standeth in the top of high places, by the way, in the places of the pass. She crieth at the gates, at the entry of the city, at the coming in, at the doors. Wisdom stands, the foolish woman sits. I kind of think that's interesting. You know how many times in the Bible we're told to stand? I didn't write them all down here, but I was thinking about this before this afternoon when I was reviewing this, and I just started looking at all the instances of the word stand and how many times it tells us to stand fast. Many, many times. I'll just give you one in Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 13 through 14 says, wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand, not sit, stand. You can't fight when you're sitting. If you're sitting and you get into a fight and you're seated, you're going to lose, because the guy's going to walk up, he's got dominance over you, and he's going to punch you in the face, and that's going to be it. You got to be standing if you want to fight. Stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness. And then he goes on to, I thought he said stand again. Anyway, he says stand a number of times there in that passage. So we're to be standing. The foolish woman is sitting. So this signifies that the foolish woman is proud and lazy, in contrast to wisdom, who is humble and diligent. And I'll show you this. Revelation 18 and verse 7. This came to me, like I said, this afternoon, so it's not in your outline, but it is, you know, I did add it to the outline. Revelation 18 and verse 7. Let me show you how she's proud and sits like a lazy bum. Revelation 18 and verse 7. How much she hath glorified herself. This is Mystery Babylon, the one that we were already looking at here. And lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her, for she saith in her heart, I sit a queen, and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. She's so proud, she thinks there's nothing could ever happen to her. She's a queen. She's never going to be dethroned. Nothing's ever going to happen. She's sitting there. She is comfortable, kind of lounging back, not worried about anything. Now look at Isaiah 47, 7 through 8. This is speaking of the old Babylon. This is the new Babylon. This is Babylon 2.0. Here's the original Babylon in Isaiah 47, 7 through 8. And look at the similarity. And thou saidst, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thine heart, neither didst remember the latter end of it. Therefore hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, and sayest in thine heart, I am, and none else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. Same thing that Mystery Babylon said. It's because they're of the same stock. They're of the same spirit. Given to pleasures, careless, lazy, and proud. That was Babylon. That's the foolish woman. In contrast to wisdom, who is humble and diligent, and who stands against the wiles of the devil. And then we're also told in Revelation 17 and verse 3 that we already read, that the woman sits on the beast. Remember that? Revelation 17, 3, and he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon the scarlet-colored beast. That's her seat. And I'll show you that really is, that fits very well with what a seat is in Scripture. It says that she sits on a seat in the high places of the city. Let me just get that whole verse again. 9:14, for she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city. So she has a seat that she sits on. Now, a seat represents authority and power. And I'll give you a few verses which will show this. I turn to Matthew 23 and verse 2. And this is a seat in religion that Jesus is talking about here. This is a position of power and authority in religion. Matthew 23 and verse 2. In verse 1, then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. They have Moses' authority. The authority that Moses had, they have that authority. Of course, they'd abused it, and Jesus tells them that whatever they bid you observe, that do it, if it's in the law of Moses. But don't do after their works, because they say and do not. Don't act like them. If your righteousness doesn't exceed the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no wise enter the kingdom of God, Jesus said. Don't act like them, but if they tell you to do something, and it's in the Bible, you do it. It doesn't matter who it's coming from. If the person is right, and if they're telling you something that's biblical, even if they're a total hypocrite, do what they say. Because really, you're just doing what God says. They just happen to be the mouthpiece. Now, let me give you another verse. Matthew 27, verse 19, Pilate sat in the judgment seat, which was a seat of authority and power. Matthew 27 and verse 19 says, when he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. Talking about Jesus. Think about where a king and a queen sit. The throne, right? The throne is their position of judgment, right? Their position of authority. Let me give you another one in Luke 1:52. Kind of getting an idea of what this seat that this woman sits on represents. Luke 1 and verse 52. It says, he hath put down, this is in the Magnificat, this is Mary's sermon. He hath put down the mighty from their seats and exalted them of low degree. Their positions of power, in other words, they've been put down from. And one more, Revelation 16 and verse 20. This is what you call Bible study. This is, you find a word or a phrase and you want to know what it means, and you just go around and you start looking in the Bible to see how that word is used other places. Revelation 16 and verse 10, and the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain. The seat of the beast. Now, this is a figurative seat, of course, because the beast is a figurative, right? The beast in this case is that world system, that world government. But it was wherever the headquarters of it were, I suppose, is probably the seat. So if he was going to come back and do that now, it would be in the White House, in the Oval Office, or something like that, I suppose. Now, the foolish woman's seat in her house is Satan's seat. Look in Revelation 2 and verse 13, because this is Satan's church. Remember that. Revelation 2 and verse 13. Jesus says to this church in Pergamos, I know thy works, Revelation 2:13. I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is. And thou holdest fast my name and hast not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwelleth. I don't know exactly where that was, but apparently he must have been in Pergamos. Obviously, and I don't know what was in Pergamos. I haven't really done any research. I think it would be extra biblical stuff. I assume, because I don't think it says in the Bible that I'm aware of. But something about Pergamos was Satan's seat, and I do remember reading something about that, but it's totally slipped my mind as to what that was. It was probably in a commentary or something, but I don't remember. But anyway, it was in Pergamos, obviously. That's where Satan's position of power and authority was. And this is that seat that this woman's sitting on, Satan's seat. Now, it's interesting that Satan claims that his seat is God's seat. This is another one that's not in your outline. But if you turn over to Ezekiel 28 and verse 2, this is interesting. Ezekiel 28 and verse 2. Now, he's speaking here to the prince of Tyrus. But remember, if you go down to verse 12, down to verse 19, he's talking here to Satan, who is animating the prince of Tyrus. And it's clear, he was in the Garden of Eden and all that. So in verse 2, though, look at this. Ezekiel 28 and verse 2, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, to Satan, in other words, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, thine heart is lifted up. That's Satan for you, right? I will be like the Most High. And thou hast said, I am a God. I sit in the seat of God, in the midst of the seas. Yet thou art a man and not God, though thou set thine heart as the heart of God. You know, popes have claimed to be that. They're sitting on the seat of Satan, right? Rome was where Satan dwelt there. That's where Mystery Babylon was, the city that sits on seven hills. It said the seven hills that she sits on are the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Rome is known as the city of seven hills. So the Pope sat there in the seat of Mystery Babylon, Satan's seat. And Satan is claiming that he's a God with a capital G, and that his seat is the seat of God, which reminds me of what Satan will do at the end of time when he appears as the man of sin, or animates the man of sin, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Look at what it says here. No, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. We're going off the outline again. I know what you were looking ahead, but 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in verse 4, he's talking about the man of sin here, and he says, the son of perdition, verse 3 there, and in verse 4 he says, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Matches up there fairly well. So Satan thinks that his seat is God's seat, and this foolish woman is sitting in Satan's seat. Has Satan's power and authority. Because Satan gives his power and authority and his seat to his servants. Revelation 13 and verse 2. Revelation 13 and verse 2. It says, And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon, that's the devil, we've already seen that in chapter 12, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So the devil gives this beast, this world empire, his seat, his power. He's sitting there, and he's got the authority of Satan himself, because Satan is the god of this world. And therefore, Satan's church is invested with the authority and power of Satan, who is the god of this world. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. You know, when Satan told Jesus, he said that he would give him, he showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time, and he said, All these will I give thee if thou wilt bow down and worship me. And Jesus replied and said, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. But what he didn't say is, You're a liar, Satan, because you don't own these kingdoms. He did. You know, that is, Satan did. He did own the kingdoms of the world. When Adam sinned, he sold the farm, the whole thing. Satan got it all. Christ now reigns over it when he was raised from the dead, and he's set above all principalities and powers and over every name that is named. But Satan still has his little fiefdom down here, and Jesus is ultimately reigning. He's going to come back and put all that down one of these days. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4, In whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. God of this world, that's talking about Satan.
It is interesting that she is lazy, yet she is in high places.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she gets there because she's fornicating with kings. Kind right. of like some women out there who gain power through selling oh, yeah. their bodies.
This is who she oh, bought yeah. her position with her body.
Yep. Right. Oh, yeah. It happens. Don't fool yourself. So Satan built his house in the high places of the city, which is the same place that Wisdom sent out her maidens from, or to call men into her house. Let's turn back to Proverbs chapter 9 again. So remember, she, in verse 14, she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city. So she has built her house, that is the foolish woman, in the high places of the city. And Wisdom sends out her ministers to call men in the high places of the city. Same place. Proverbs 9 and verse 3. She has sent forth her maidens, this is talking about Wisdom, she crieth upon the highest places of the city. So they're both in the same place. Isn't that interesting? Well, Satan putting his house in the high places of the city accomplishes two purposes. Number one, it provides a nearby alternative to God's church. It's always good, you know, to have one right down the road because people love convenience. Today, there's a lot of people. If you say, how far away is your church? If you said 15 minutes, they're like, oh, I can't drive that far. Oh, I mean, they just want to go to literally the closest one, the one down the street. If it's not 5 minutes away, it's too far.
On TV, you don't have to go anywhere now.
Right, exactly, yes. Let alone, say, an hour or something. I mean, most people, you mentioned driving an hour to church, and they'd look at you like you have two heads. So it's good to have nearby ones. That's why, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they got a couple of them around here. They got one right out here on 69 Highway, and they got one on 10 Highway, and they'd like to have lots of options.
There's one between us and Richmond, too.
210. Oh, there's one down there, too. Oh.
Yes, there is.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. 210. Oh. Yeah.
Would you believe it's got no windows?
Yeah.
None of them do.
Now, there are some that actually do have windows. I asked a Jehovah's Witness about that one time. He was from the UK, and he called me up. He really just wanted to argue, I think. But anyway, we had a talk, a couple of talks, I think. And I asked him, he asked me if I had any questions for him. And I asked him, why don't your buildings have any windows in them? And he said some of them do. And then he used this stupid excuse about, you know, in high vandalism areas, they don't have windows in them because... I think, well, this isn't one of them, so I don't know what the excuse is for no windows around here, other than maybe secrecy, not wanting people to know what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. Now, the other reason that Satan would build his house in the high places where Wisdom goes out and cries unto men to repent is that it affords his false churches access to the most amount of people possible. Remember, when we were back in Proverbs chapter 8, I noted there that Wisdom goes where the people are. Right, she goes to the highest places of the city. She goes to the gates where all the people congregate. There in Proverbs 8, 2 through 3. She standeth in the top of high places. By the way, in the places of the pass, she crieth at the gates, at the entry of the city, at the coming in at the doors. So she wants access to the most amount of people possible. Well, so does Satan. He wants the same thing. So by setting up shop right where Wisdom does, he's got access to Wisdom's people, and he's got access to all those other people out there that Wisdom's calling to as well. And then that will take us to the next verse, Proverbs 9 and verse 15. Turn to Proverbs 9:15. So I think this one will be shorter and interesting stuff, I think. Proverbs 9:15 says to call passengers who go right on their ways. So just to get the context... verse 13, a foolish woman is clamorous, she is simple and knoweth nothing, for she sitteth at the door of her house on a seat in the high places of the city to call passengers who go right on their ways. So here we've already looked at last verse that this foolish woman represents Satan and his religion. And she sets up shop right where Wisdom does, in the high places. And just as wisdom was calling people, well, the foolish woman is calling people too, to call passengers. A passenger is a passerby or through. So a passerby or a passer through. A traveler, usually on foot, a wayfarer. So the foolish woman, this is Satan's religion, as we've already looked at, targets men who are not in the security of their own home or church. They're traveling. They're passing through. So they're not in a safe place necessarily. She likes to catch people like that. She tries to catch them when they're on the road, so to speak. And many times when travelers travel, they travel alone. And that makes them more vulnerable to her enticement. Look in Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12. You think about it, a lot of times when you're traveling alone. That's why when you get on these main highways going into cities, they'll have a high occupancy lane that if there are two or more people in the car, you can drive in that lane because most people are alone. They're by themselves, right? Well, when you're by yourself, you're more susceptible to get harmed or deceived or something like that. And this is what Solomon is teaching us here. You're a lot safer when you're with somebody else. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12 says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So it's better to have somebody else with you. Just in life, you know, it's good. You know, no man is an island, as they say. And it's especially good spiritually to have other people around you, right? When you're off by yourself, I get worried about it. If I hear about any Christians that like to be off by themselves and they don't want to come to church anymore for some reason, or they don't want to get together with people in church, they just want to do their own thing. That's concerning because, you know, that person is weak. They could be easily brought down. So she calls passengers, people that are passing on through, passing by, who go right on their ways. Now, to go right on one's way is to take a direct course without erring. Right, the adverb, means of motion or position, straight, in a direct course or line. So it's not saying they're going right as in morally right or correct, necessarily. They're going right on their way. They're going in a straight line or course. Okay. Now, the right way is a straight way which doesn't deviate to the right or to the left. Proverbs 4, 25 through 27. Now, she could also be calling people that are going on the right way, morally, religiously speaking, too, of course. She does that. Proverbs 4, 25 through 27. Let thine eyes look right on, and let thine eyelids look straight before thee. Ponder the path of thy feet, let all thy ways be established. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left, remove thy foot from evil. So physically, spiritually, to go right on your way is to go in a straight line and not deviate to the right or to the left. And that's the trick. The trick to the Christian life is staying on the straight and narrow and not deviating one way or the other. Because you always err in the extremes, right? You can take anything to the extreme. You could take a person that the Bible teaches moderation in alcohol consumption, for one thing. And one person could say, it is a sin to drink any alcohol at all. And guess what? He's now excluded himself from the Lord's table. That's an error. Somebody else could say, you can drink as much as you want. That's also an error, isn't it? Right? The truth is down the middle. Of course, you have premillennialism, postmillennialism, and then amillennialism down the middle. Or you have Catholicism and Protestantism and Baptist down the middle, right? So there's always two errors that Satan likes to give you, on the right or on the left, Democrats, Republicans, whatever, right? You're always given two bad choices.
Or you could be overly righteous and a little bit loose or something.
Yes, yep. You could be too strict, you could be more holy than God, making up all kinds of rules and commandments for yourself and others that God never said. Or you could be way too loose and just say, well, you know, God saves by grace, we can just live however we want. Let us do evil that good may come. Right? So there's always those two extremes, and the truth is in the middle usually. So the foolish woman targets men who are walking on a straight course trying to get where they're going. It's not always the most effective tactic either. I've tried that before. I did an interview one time, not the one where I got arrested, but the other one, at the lake. And when people were walking straight on their way and I was trying to ask them about questions about their belief in God, they usually didn't want to talk to you. So hopefully the devil has as much luck as I did getting people to talk to him, because people didn't want to talk about God when I tried to do it anyway, up there in that godless city. So the foolish woman seeks to distract them from their planned destination to get them to veer from it. Anything to get you off the path. Satan's happy with whatever. You know, whether it's some strict fundamentalist cult or whether it's a strip club, right? It doesn't matter. If he can get you off the path, one way or the other, he's happy about it. The foolish woman's like a billboard sign which catches the attention of drivers and causes them to either run off the road or, worse yet, to take the next exit to a sinful destination. Mm-hmm. You ever drive Interstate 80 past Gary, Indiana? And there are other places in the country like this too. Gary, Indiana. Oh, it is the armpit of America. I told Seth that one time. And then she's like, what's that mean or something? And so I Googled armpit of America and Gary, Indiana came up. I kid you not. I mean, I thought I came up with that. And I didn't. So
I thought it was Fort Polk, Louisiana myself.
Well, everybody's got two armpits. So.
That's true.
But you drive by Gary. I mean, you can tell when you start driving down an interstate, and all the billboards are for strip clubs. You're in a bad place. And there are places. I mean, there's places in Missouri like that actually. Go in there, and I think going down to Branson, there was a place where I remembered somewhere seeing a lot of those. Maybe not, but yeah, it's generally not a good place. Yep. So that's what she's like the billboard, trying to get you to run off the road and crash or else pull off into the strip club, one of the two. Now, Satan's false churches use all kinds of tactics to call men to veer off the way of righteousness, such as missionaries knocking on doors. The Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses do this, such as deceptive TV ads. I don't know if the Mormons, I haven't watched TV for 17 years or something, but they used to, when I was a kid, have ads on TV. The Mormons did, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they were really catchy, wholesome type commercials. It really, when you saw that, you're like, wow, that just seems like a really nice church, just a nice group of people. You want to be a part of that. And they had no idea it was some devil worshiping cult. You know, I didn't know that when I was a kid. I just thought there was another Christian church of some kind, right? It says Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints. What's that mean? You know, when you're a kid, I didn't know anything. Or televangelists, radio preachers, movies, YouTube videos, whatever. I mean, this is the foolish woman now calling passengers who go right on their ways trying to get you to veer off the road. And it's all over the internet. It's all over YouTube. For every true video there is out there, for every sermon that preaches truth on YouTube, there are thousands of them that preach heresy. Satan's really got the whole thing flooded. Now, wisdom leads men in right paths. The foolish woman calls men off of them. I'll give you two more verses and we'll be done. Proverbs 4 and verse 11. Wisdom says, or Solomon says, I have taught thee in the way of wisdom. I have led thee in right paths. The book of Proverbs, the wisdom of God, leads you on right paths. But what does the foolish woman do in verse 16? Says to call passengers to go right on their ways, verse 15, and what's she say? Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. As for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him. She's calling him off the right path, trying to get him to come into her church. And we'll talk about that next Bible study, Lord willing.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.